As we said last hour, when we look at the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the evidences for the resurrection, there are two lines of evidences. First of all, there is the line that deals with the testimony of the witnesses. And that, of course, has to be examined. The testimony of these witnesses is incorporated in the testimony of the evangelists. And so, therefore, we read Matthew and we read Mark and Luke and John, and we assess the testimony of these witnesses. Sometimes the testimony is the testimony of these men themselves. At other times, it is a testimony that they make about others. For instance, let me show you the distinction between those two things. John said over in 1 John chapter 1, and of course he is the author of the Gospel of John, "That which was from the beginning, that which we have heard, that which we have seen with our eyes, that which we beheld, and our hands handled concerning the word of life. And the life was manifested, and we have seen and bear witness, and declare unto you the life, the eternal life, which was with the Father, and was manifested unto us. That which we have seen and heard, declare we unto you, that ye also may have fellowship with us." Here is a strong affirmation of the fact that these individuals were eyewitnesses of what they saw. Back in 2 Peter chapter 1, Peter had this to say about this matter of eyewitness testimony. In 2 Peter chapter 1, beginning in verse 16, "We did not follow cunningly devised fables when we made known unto you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but were eyewitnesses of His majesty." So here we have both Peter and John suggesting that they were eyewitnesses of what took place. Then there is the kind of evidence that is written about the eyewitness testimony, the objective presentation of the historian. Look with me, if you will, over at Luke, the first chapter, and the introduction to Luke's gospel, where Luke does not claim to have seen a single thing that he records, but he does claim to have recorded them with historical accuracy. "For as much as many have taken in hand to draw up a narrative concerning those matters which have been fulfilled among us, even as they delivered them unto us, who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, it seemed good to me also, having traced the course of all things accurately from the first, to write unto thee in order, most excellent Theophilus, that thou mightest know the certainty concerning the things wherein thou wast instructed." Now we do know from those who have examined statements within the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts that Luke was meticulously accurate with regard to what he had to say. There was an archaeologist, a scholar, a classical scholar by the name of Sir William Ramsay. And he went on an expedition throughout Turkey, throughout Asia Minor, to examine the terrain and the archaeological evidence. And he began as a skeptic. He did not believe that Luke was accurate in what he said. When he finished his studies, his investigations, he had become convinced that Luke was accurate, and it made a believer out of him. He made use of this turn of events and wrote numerous books that are still available. The truth of the matter was that Sir William Ramsay found out that some of the Roman historians were inaccurate in their descriptions and that Luke was accurate over against what they had to say. And when it came to the matter of contradiction between the two, that Luke is the one who came out as the correct historian as opposed to the others. And so therefore, we can have confidence in Luke as an historian, and there have been volumes of books written on that. And so therefore, his second-hand testimony is worthy of investigation. And certainly when it is compared with the first-hand testimony of a Matthew or a Peter or of a John, then it becomes even that more significant to us. But the other line of evidence has to do with the physical evidence. And primarily, that evidence centers around what we have referred to as the case of the empty tomb. I want us to give consideration to certain facts that are established apart from the miraculous element of the events that surround the death, the burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. It seems as though that we can find out from the account that Jesus said while he was alive that he would rise from the dead. He predicted this. Not only is that true, but there is the evidence that he died. His legs were not broken by the Roman soldiers because he was presumed already to be dead. These were men who were commonly and habitually practicing this act on those who were crucified. And therefore, in their judgment, Jesus had already expired. We know also that he was buried, and we also know that a report was circulated that on the third day the tomb was found to be empty. In the fourth place, we find out, or in the third place, that for 40 days there were reports of people having seen Jesus alive. And then these appearances suddenly stopped. We know that at the time of Pentecost, following this fact of the empty tomb, that a message began to be preached that Jesus was Lord and Christ, and that believers came to be founded upon this fact and constituted the church. We know that that church has continued from that time until the present and stands as a memorial to the fact that many people believed these incidents. What I would like for us to give consideration to is the matter of the empty tomb. The physical evidence seems to be that Jesus was placed in a tomb, and then 3 days later, the body was missing. Now, there are some things about the character of this tomb that we need to examine for just a moment. I really cannot tell you where this information originally came from. You can see it in many sources. I'll tell you where I got this originally. I got this way back in the early 1950s from a little handout of James P. Miller. I have seen it numerous times in other works. I have really never, for myself, been able to take it back to its documented source. Now, I tell you that because these points were written by someone else in their words, and I simply am sharing them with you. In the first place, Jesus was buried in a new tomb. It's very significant that we understand that. I would like for you to look at the biblical reference on this. Turn over to Luke, if you will, to the 23rd chapter and the 53rd verse, I believe it is. He took him down and wrapped him in a linen cloth and laid him in a tomb that was hewn in stone, where never man had yet lain." Now that's a very significant little point that is buried in the gospel accounts of the resurrection. Because if there were others that had entered the tomb before Jesus, then it would have been much more likely that a hoax could have been accomplished. But this was a new tomb. It was a tomb where never man had yet lain. Conclusion. No error could be made by seeing other bodies or bones of former dead. So, when the witnesses went in and examined, they were not examining the wrong body. They were not seeing a group of bones that did not belong to Jesus. Second, the tomb was cut in solid rock. And it's important that we understand that's the case. It was a tomb that had one entrance. The entrance was also the exit. It was cut back into the rock like a cave. And so therefore, it was not a matter that you could put the body in the front door and slip it out the back door. It's important that we understand this. Back in Matthew chapter 27, if you will look there for just a moment, you find this reference, I think it is, in the 60th verse, as follows. "Joseph of Arimathea took the body, wrapped it in a linen cloth, laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn out in a rock." The conclusion. No other entrance was there to the tomb. Jesus would have been powerless by human strength to have emerged. Now, I saw Superman. Superman 1, Superman 2, Superman 3, and however many more there may be, I may see. And I know that Superman just dove down into the earth, into the volcanic eruptive center, and did marvelous things. But don't you try that. You know, we better be careful about the heroes that our children have. A lady was looking out her window recently. She was a member of the church. And she looked out in her window, and there stood her child right out in the oncoming traffic. Fortunately, as I remember the story, somebody saw the child and knocked the child out of the way before a car ran over him. When his mother asked the child, "What in the world were you doing?" He said, "I was standing there, but there wasn't anything to worry about." He said, "I had the power." She said, "Well, where did you get the power?" And he said, "These two sticks, these swords constituted my power." He had seen this on a comic strip on television. Well, Superman doesn't work in the real world. And the fact of the matter is that unless you assume that he was divine, unless you do assume that he was a Superman, Jesus was not going to burrow through the solid rock walls of that tomb. Well, that only leaves the entrance way. Fact number 3, the tomb was sealed with a great stone. Look at Matthew chapter 27, beginning in verse 62. "Now on the morrow, which is the day after the preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees were gathered together unto Pilate, saying, 'Sir, we remember that deceiver said, while he was yet alive, after 3 days I will rise again. Command, therefore, that the sepulchre be made sure until the third day, lest haply his disciples come and steal him away and say unto the people, He is risen from the dead, and the last error will be worse than the first.' Pilate said unto them, ye have a guard, go make it as sure as you can. So they went and made the sepulchre sure, sealing the stone, the guard being with them. The tomb was sealed with a great stone, and it was posted with a Roman guard. Conclusion. If three women could not roll the stone away from the outside, according to Mark 16:3, Jesus, in his weakened condition, could not have done so. Fact number four. A most careful survey was made of the contents of the tomb. Look, if you will, at Luke 24:12. Peter arose and ran unto the tomb, and stooping and looking in, he seeth the linen clothes by themselves. And he departed to his home, wondering at that which was come to pass. There was a most careful survey that was made of these things. Now look also, if you will, in John's Gospel, over in the 20th chapter of John. In John chapter 20, I want to begin reading with you in the 6th verse. There John records. Maybe I should begin a little earlier so that you will get the context. I'm just going to start on the 20th chapter in the very first verse. Now on the first day of the week cometh Mary Magdalene early while it was yet dark unto the tomb, and seeth the stone taken away from the tomb. She runneth therefore and cometh to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved, and saith unto them, they have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we know not where they have laid him. Peter therefore went forth, and the other disciple, and they went toward the tomb. Now by internal evidence, you can figure out by process of elimination that this other disciple was John himself, who's writing this account. They ran both together, and the other disciple outran Peter and came to the tomb. And stooping and looking in, it's important, I think, that we understand what's involved here. Let's say that this is a mountainside. And what has happened is that there has been cut a little narrow passage into this mountainside. And then inside there has been cut this tomb. In order for an individual to get into this particular tomb, and there had been a big stone that had been placed over the mouth of it to seal it, a person just really had to stoop way down, hover, in fact, in order to walk through this and get inside the tomb and look. And so, therefore, it says concerning this other disciple that he came first to the tomb and stooping and looking in, seeth the linen clothes lying, yet he entered not in. Simon Peter therefore also cometh, following him, and entered into the tomb. And he beholdeth the linen clothes lying, and the napkin which was upon the head, not lying with the linen clothes, but rolled up in a place by itself. Then entered in therefore the other disciple. You know, here are the two witnesses. Then entered in, therefore, the other disciple also who came first to the tomb, and he saw and believed. For as yet they knew not the scripture, it simply means they didn't fully understand, that he must rise again from the dead. So the disciples went away again unto their own home. There was, therefore, a most careful survey made of the contents of the tomb. Conclusion. The witnesses made careful survey of the tomb and were able to testify about what they saw. Linen clothes in one place and the face cloth or the napkin in another place. Very, very carefully separated from one another. And these are the physical evidences that are involved. Beside the tomb itself and the problems that are associated with the fact that someone could pull off a snow job about this, there is the problem of the disappearance of the body of Jesus. Again, I really don't know where this goes back, but this also is information that has been available as long, I suppose, as individuals have been discussing this matter of the body of Jesus. Number one, it is said that the disciples could not steal the body and dispose of it successfully. Well, why? Turn to Matthew chapter 27, if you will, and look beginning at the 62nd verse. Matthew chapter 27, and begin at the 62nd verse. We looked at this, we looked at another passage earlier. Now on the morrow, which is the day of the preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees were gathered together unto Pilate, saying, Sir, we remember that that deceiver said while he was yet alive, after 3 days I will rise again. We did read this earlier. Command, therefore, that the sepulcher be made sure until the third day, lest haply his disciples come and steal him away, and say unto the people, He is risen from the dead, and the last error will be worse than the first. And so Pilate said, You have a guard, go, make it as sure as you can. So they went and made the sepulcher sure, sealing the stone, the guard being with them. Now, not only is that true, but the fact of the matter is, the Jews would not steal the body. They didn't want to steal the body. The best evidence that they could produce that Jesus was not the Christ was to keep that body in the grave. The disciples couldn't steal the body because of the guard. The Jews wouldn't steal the body because they would be defeating themselves in doing so. And then finally, the Romans dared not steal the body. And these were the only parties that were involved to be taken into consideration. The disciples, the Jews, and the Romans. It was a capital offense for a guard to allow a tomb to be plundered. In Acts 16:27, you remember that the jailer was ready to fall on his own sword and take his life because he feared that the prisoners had escaped. In Matthew chapter 28, verses 11, I want you to notice what is recounted following the alleged resurrection. Now, while they were going, behold, some of the guard came into the city and told unto the chief priests all the things that were come to pass. Now notice this. These are Roman guards, but they didn't go to their Roman officials. They went to the Jewish officials and told them. And when they were assembled with the elders and had taken counsel, they gave much money to the soldiers, saying, Say ye, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we slept. And if this come to the governor's ears, we will persuade him and rid you of care. So they took the money and did as they were taught. And this saying was spread abroad among the Jews and continueth unto this day. Now that last statement is real stupid if it's not true. I don't know. And yet, I feel pretty good about it. I think that just common sense tells you some things. Now notice that last statement there in Matthew's gospel. The guards took the money, did as they were taught. This saying, that is, as to what they did, was spread abroad among the Jews, not the disciples, among the Jews, and continues until this day. Matthew is saying, it's no secret what the Jewish officials did. This is common knowledge. And the point is, people are assumed to be conversant with those things that are occurring around them. If Jesus was not raised from the dead, it would have been very simple for two witnesses who met all of the qualifications of true witnesses that we studied last hour to come forward and to expose the whole charade. But they did not. All right? We need to also recognize the fact that the empty tomb didn't even convince the disciples that Jesus was raised from the dead. They were astounded. The women came to the tomb and they saw the circumstances and they thought perhaps that somebody must have removed the body from the tomb. They didn't immediately say, well, look, it's exactly the way the Lord said. He said He would rise from the dead. His body's not there. He's risen from the dead. This fact had to be pounded in their heads because they were not gullible people. Neither the women nor the men were gullible with respect to that. I'd like for you to think about something in that connection, about the fact that these individuals were not really, really gullible. If they had been, then one of these explanations would have been true. I want to point this over. This is in a book by Arlie J. Hoover on evidences. It's a good little chart, and it really kind of focuses on these matters quite clearly. How would one explain the missing body if Jesus was not raised from the dead? Well, there are a number of lines of evidence involved in this, and look at them here. There is the evidence of the empty tomb. There is the evidence of the appearances. There is the evidence of the tremendous change that took place in the lives of the apostles. And there is, of course, the testimony of the church itself. Now, let's look at the theories to explain all these evidences. Take the fact that someone theorizes that Jesus did indeed rise from the dead, that this is where the evidences lead. That explanation fits all of the lines of evidences. It explains the empty tomb. It explains the testimony of those who say that Jesus appeared to them. It explains the dedication, the determination, the sacrifice of the apostles throughout their lives, holding true to what they had said. And it explains the perseverance of the church throughout the centuries. The fact that people have continued to believe this for 20 centuries would make a whole lot of people absolutely and completely gullible about something that some seem to think is so apparently a lie. Well, now let's look at alternate explanations of it. So far as I know, these are the other five alternate explanations that have been offered. There is, first of all, the fact that the body was stolen, or I should say the theory that the body was stolen. Well, let's examine that theory in the light of the evidences. Does this explain the empty tomb? Yes, it does. If Jesus had risen from the dead, the tomb would be empty. But if his body had been stolen, then the tomb would be empty. Because a dead body was put in there and a dead body was stolen out of there. Does this explain the testimony of those who say that Jesus appeared to them? No, it doesn't. It would explain the empty tomb, but it would not explain the appearances. Does it explain the profound effect on the lives of the apostles? No, it does not. Does it really explain the conviction that has been the bedrock of the church? And the answer is no, it doesn't explain that either. The only thing that it explains is the empty tomb, but the evidence is solidly against the possibility of anybody stealing the body. All right, another alternate theory is that the women came to the wrong tomb. Well, would that explain the empty tomb? Well, maybe so. I've got a question mark there. At least Arlie Hoover has a question mark there. And the reason is if they went to the wrong tomb, the question might be whether or not that tomb was sealed or not sealed, whether there were any bodies in it or not bodies in it. There's some question about whether or not it would even satisfy the fact that the tomb was empty. But secondly, does it satisfy the appearances that Jesus made to these women? And the answer is no, it doesn't. If they went to the wrong tomb, Jesus wouldn't even have been involved anyway. But they claimed that he appeared to some of them. In the third place, does it explain the profound effect that it had on the lives of the apostles? And again, no. Does it explain the church? And the answer again is no. Well, another alternate explanation is the so-called hallucination theory. The hallucination theory. There are those who would try and argue that Jesus, in fact, was not raised from the dead, that the disciples simply imagined that he was raised from the dead, and they hallucinated the whole thing. You're familiar with the fact that sometimes people are staggering out across the desert and they see the water hole out there. Well, it really isn't there. They're hallucinating. Were the disciples hallucinating? At first glance, you would say, well, that sounds reasonable. People hallucinate today. But may I suggest four things that indicate that the disciples were not hallucinating? Number one, if you study the psychology of hallucinations, you find out that hallucinations seldom appear to crowds of people. You hallucinate one at a time, so to speak. You hallucinate in isolation. Second, hallucinations seldom occur to all personality types. Psychologists will tell you that there is a personality type that has hallucinations. Everybody doesn't hallucinate. Some people hallucinate. And if you examine enough people who hallucinate, you'll find out that they have the same psychological characteristics. And you can almost predict in some cases whether a person is going to hallucinate or not. In the third place, hallucinations seldom are misinterpreted. But this hallucination apparently was misinterpreted. And fourth, hallucinations stop as suddenly as they started. But this hallucination kept going on and on and on, from one people to small groups of people to large groups of people. And so therefore, there is not a thing about the appearances of Jesus Christ that would indicate that the disciples were hallucinating. In fact, there is enough said about the apostles in the Gospels and in the book of Acts to strongly suggest to us that these men were not the type of men that have hallucinations. All right. Another alternate theory is the so-called objective vision theory. Well, does it explain the empty tomb? No, it doesn't. Because if it's a vision, then the tomb's not empty. The body's still in it. They just think that someone objectively has come down to them, like in the form of an apparition. Does it explain the appearances? Yes, it would explain the appearances. Does it explain the effect that this had on the lives of the apostles? It's doubtful that it would. Does it explain the continued existence of the church? No, it's doubtful that it would. Finally, there is the swoon theory. I guess this one has been the most popular of all, but it is the most absurd of all. This one says that Jesus fainted on the cross, and that he was thought to be dead, that he was taken down from the dead, eventually was put into the tomb, and then revived, found himself in the tomb, and got out. That's the so-called swoon theory. Does it explain the empty tomb? Well, yes, it would, if it's true. Does it explain the appearances? Yes, it does. Does it explain the effect on the lives of the apostles? No, it doesn't, because they would have known in reality that Jesus didn't die. Would it have explained the establishment and the strength of growth in the church? It's doubtful that it would have. But the whole thing is just as patently absurd as it can possibly be. Let me, if I may, suggest something in this connection to you that I feel would be important. There was a careful examination of these evidences by a contemporary scholar named George Eldon Ladd. And he was examining this psychology of these individuals who claim to have seen the Lord. He says, the facts in the Gospels indicate that the disciples really experienced something. Somebody says, oh yes, they experienced something. They experienced an objective vision. They experienced hallucinations. Did they? Ladd says, what caused these subjective experiences? You can go in and read the textbooks about what causes hallucinations. And then you go back and begin to understand what is recorded in the Gospels, and you're left with a real question. What caused these subjective experiences? Second, certainly not a glowing expectation of the resurrection, because the disciples only had despair and discouragement. In fact, in Mark, the 16th chapter and the 9th verse, or the 8th verse, let me just read chapter 16, 1 through 8, because there are those who try and contend that this is the way the gospel ended. Mark chapter 16, 1 through 8. Listen to it. When the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome brought spices that they might come and anoint him. And very early, on the first day of the week, they come to the tomb when the sun was risen, and they were saying among themselves, "Who shall roll us away the stone from the door of the tomb?" And looking up, they see that the stone was rolled back, for it was exceeding great. And entering into the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, arrayed in a white robe, and they were amazed. And he said to them, "Be not amazed. Ye seek Jesus, the Nazarene, who hath been crucified. He is risen. He is not here. Behold the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter, he goeth before you into Galilee. There shall ye see him, as he said unto you." And they went out of the tomb and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had come upon them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. It doesn't sound like these individuals were out to tell a great fish story and to convince everybody of what happened. They kept their mouth shut until the evidence was so overwhelming that they just couldn't keep it back. Again, Ladd says, "Experiences that they had, therefore, were caused by empirical evidences provided by their risen Lord." Now, if Jesus did what he did, you can explain the change in the skepticism of Thomas. "Unless I can see with my eyes, unless I can handle with my hands, I will not believe that he was raised from the dead." When Jesus comes in and says, "Thomas, look and touch," Thomas says, "My Lord and my God." You can explain that on the fact that Jesus did appear. You can't explain it on the fact that they just had some kind of psychological experience. So the confession of Thomas is really the ringer when all is said and done. I want to make some statements from some various scholars, and then I want to conclude by reading once again this incident between Jesus and Thomas. First of all, a statement from a scholar named Brooke Foss Westcott, F.B. Westcott, one of the great scholars of a previous age. "Indeed," he says, "taking all the evidence together, it is not too much to say that there is no historic incident better or more variously supported than the resurrection of Christ. Nothing but the antecedent assumption that it must be false could have suggested the idea of deficiency in the proof of it." Which is exactly what Machen said. We're not dealing with an historical problem here. We're dealing with a philosophical problem. If a person agrees with Hume that miracles don't happen, there is no amount of evidence, there's no amount of testimony that you can bring forth that would convince me that they happen, nobody's going to believe in the resurrection. Then there is the statement that is made by Lord Darling of England, former Chief Justice, a very, very significant man. He said, "In its favor, as a living truth, there exists such overwhelming evidence, positive and negative, factual and circumstantial, that no intelligent jury in the world could fail to bring in a verdict that the resurrection story is true." J.N.D. Anderson, who is an international scholar of eminent qualification today, he is one of the world's leading authorities on Islamic law. Here are some of the things that he has accomplished. Dean of the law, or of law in the University of London, chairman of the Department of Oriental Law at the School of Oriental and African Studies, director of the Institute of Advanced Legal Studies in the University of London. Here's what he says. The evidence for the historical basis of the Christian faith, for the essential validity of the New Testament witness to the person and teaching of Christ himself, and for the historicity of the empty tomb and the apostolic testimony of the resurrection is such as to provide an adequate foundation for the venture of faith. Now, having read that statement by Anderson, let me tell you that Anderson is a great scholar in the field of comparative religions. He studies the Hindu religion, the Buddhist religion, the Confucianist religion, and all the others, the religions of Islam, Judaism, Christianity, and compares them. I want you to burn one thing on your mind and remember it. There is a wall of partition that exists between the religions of the world and what are referred to as the religions of the book. And I mean by the book, the Bible. There really are only two that are straightforwardly from the book. One is the Hebrew religion, and the other is the Christian religion. And then there is what is referred to as a heresy of Judaism and Christianity, the Islamic religion. Because they claim to have built on the foundation of both the Hebrew and the Christian religion, believing that Abraham, Moses, and Christ were all prophets, but that Muhammad was the greatest of the prophets. At least, they try to some extent to base what they believe on the religion of the book, though they contradict it woefully. All of these are based upon historical facts. When you get outside of these two, and to some extent this trilogy, every one of these are based upon psychology. They are personal experiences. They are individualistically tailored religions. They are totally without the possibility of any historical proof and validity. When I was a kid, I didn't even know what the word transcendental meditation meant. But it's old hat here in the United States. I didn't know what yoga and yogis were. But the fact of the matter is, those are terms that are thrown about a lot today. Eastern religion is a religion of meditation. Eastern religion is a religion of psychological self-discipline. Eastern religion could care less what happens in the real world. The fact of the matter is, most religions of the East deny that there is any reality to the real world. And what an individual does, he has to think himself out of existence. He has to deny his own individual existence in order to be a believer in the religion. Christianity stands out like a jewel in this respect. Now, having said that, I want to conclude with one quotation from a Jewish scholar who does not believe in the resurrection. And then we want to read the account of Thomas. This is in a very recent book by a Jewish scholar named Kornfeld. And the book is called The Historical Jesus. Here's what he says. And I'm going to read you these several quotations. The first one is from page 182. And the next two from page 183 and the last from page 184. Looking at these theories, as an historian, a Jewish historian, a person who's never been convinced of the truthfulness of Christianity. He says no one theory explains all the phenomena reported at that time. And it would take an incredible combination of several of them to begin to do so. Now, really what he's doing is he's talking about these theories right here. The stolen body theory, the wrong tomb theory, the hallucination theory, the objective vision theory, the swoon theory. This much must be admitted. Not merely on any basis of Christian apologetic, but on sober historical inquiry. Not a one of these really gives an adequate alternative to what the New Testament affirms. But it is the reaction of the priestly authorities that even to the neutral historian must constitute evidence for an empty tomb. The temple establishment did not do the obvious to counter the apostles' preaching. They did not lead an official procession out to Joseph's tomb. They did not because they knew the tomb was empty. Many facts from antiquity rest on just one ancient source, where two or three sources in agreement generally are in agreement, they generally render the fact unimpeachable. In this case, that is of the empty tomb, there are at least seven ancient sources, the four Gospels, the book of Acts, Paul, and Peter's letters. Well into the second century AD, and long after recorded its first instance, the Jerusalem authorities continued to admit an empty tomb by ascribing it to the disciples stealing the body. In his dialogue with Trephy, Justin Martyr reported in 150 AD that Jewish authorities even sent specially commissioned men across the Mediterranean to counter Christian claims with this explanation. I think I made a misprint here. Is it Trypho? Isn't that the way you pronounce his name? That Justin Martyr was speaking against. They just kept this story up that the disciple stole the body. The disciple stole the body over against the physical evidence of the possibility of anyone accomplishing that. And so we're left with this reality of the resurrection. Thomas, one of the 12 called Didymus, was not with the disciples when Jesus appeared. The other disciples therefore said to him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said unto them, "Except I see in his hands the print of the nails, and put my finger into the print of the nails, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." And after 8 days again his disciples were within, and Thomas with them. Jesus cometh, the doors being shut, and stood in the midst and said, "Peace be unto you." Then said he to Thomas, "Reach hither thy finger, and see my hands. And reach hither thy hand, and put it into my side. And be not faithless, but believing." Thomas answered, and said unto him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to Thomas, "Because thou hast seen me, thou hast believed. Blessed are they that have not seen and yet have believed." Thank you.